Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Zone Media.
Welcome to Could Happen Here, a podcast being recorded through a maze of painkillers. I'm your host, Bia Wong. I'm fucking dying.
With me is James.
Yeah, fentanyl episode. You've been waiting for it. Here it is.
Yeah, and the other thing that's died, sort of, was a bunch of French colonists in Algeria.
Yeah. The French Empire as a whole, one could say.
Yeah, thank God. Jesus Christ. Why did we let these people have an empire? Terrible idea.
Yeah. Not an empire, the abroad France, right? The little parts of France which just happened to be in Africa, totally a normal thing. Which particular part of the French Empire are we talking about? There are many such cases of French Empire taking L's. Not that that's unique, to be fair. Also, British Empire took a lot of L's.
Yeah, so today we're talking about Algeria. And I think one of the things that I sort of realized about how the Algerian Revolution is remembered in the West is okay. So there's the kind of the Frank Herbert reaction where they saw people who were Muslim in the streets and were like, "Holy shit!" and went insane for 70 years.
Yeah.
To be fair, that was also partly being driven mad by the Portland Dunes, which, like, you know, like I get sometimes you're driven completely insane by dunes, but. You know, so there's a sort of reactionary memory of it. There's a sort of memory that functions in inside of like the American military, where, you know, Algeria is remembered as one of those sort of like examples of failed counterinsurgency.
Yeah.
And then there's the memory inside of the American left, which is largely confined to Fanon and the movie The Battle of Algiers.
Yep. Classic movie, to be fair.
Yeah, great movie. Like, nothing. Good movie. However, this is a real issue because the Battle of Algiers, again, great movie, ends in 1957. Fanon, great theorist, dies in 1961. Now, notably, Algeria gains independence 1962. So, okay, the issue with this is that people kind of broadly know the outlines of the first Algerian Revolution. But the second Algerian Revolution, the one where the Algerian working class seizes the control of the means of production and attempts to run them autonomously, has completely faded into the mist of history. I talk about it. No one has any idea what the fuck I'm talking about. And this is kind of startling because you know, up until there's probably like there's like a 4 year span where the Algerian Revolution is the sort of like capital S, capital R social revolution. Like it's the big one. It's the one people all over the world are taking inspiration from. And then it kind of, you know, it flounders out for reasons that we're going to talk about. And also the Cultural Revolution starts and everyone latches onto that. But it's sort of fascinating to me that this the second part of the revolution and the part that everyone was really excited about, which is the core of the revolution being worker self-management. And that being the sort of great theoretical innovation of Algerian socialism, that has just completely faded from memory. It's just gone. And so today we're talking about that revolution. Unfortunately, one of the most detailed studies on this I'm going to be citing from a lot is Ian Clegg's Worker Self-Management in Algeria. Now, this is a good book. However, Clegg is... he's a very specific kind of curmudgeon-y Marxist guy.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that kind of guy.
Yeah, and so like the back third of this book is him engaged in a protracted ideological war with Fanon over the nature of revolutionary consciousness, which is largely pointless and goes nowhere.
Yeah.
So
many such cases,
you know. But it is a very, very detailed and very useful account of what actually happened after the first revolution, like after the French are forced to pull out of Algeria. And what happens effectively is, well, okay, we need to go back a little tiny bit. So there are, you know, there is a staggering slaughter of people who attempt to resist French colonialism, like a lot of the sort of techniques that are going to be used in Vietnam, that are going to be used all over the world in counterinsurgencies, are developed in Algeria in this period. I'm going to read a quote from Clegg about what they were doing. The use of air power and napalm to clear cover made movement inside the country almost impossible. The construction of mined and electrified barriers along the border with Tunisia and Morocco kept the better trained and armed elements of the Armée de Libération Nationale from coming to support the guerrillas and moving in supplies. One of the most successful moves in countering guerrilla activity was the policy of regroupment initiated by General Chalet. This strategy, learned from the British in Malaysia, involved moving the rural population out of areas favorable to the guerrillas and resettling them in camps under military guard. An estimated 2 million peasants were treated this way, creating vast social and economic problems for the future. So, like, they put 2 million people in concentration camps.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. Calling it like regroupement is a fucking exercise in like in marketing. Like, rarely have I seen something so nefariously named. Like, we're regrouping them (parentheses) in a fucking concentration camp.
Yeah, and this is a strategy that, you know, so the British sort of start doing this in Malaysia. A lot of it's derived from attempts to counter, you know, and this isn't really an episode about that Algerian revolution, but I want to talk about this a little bit. It's designed as a way to counter sort of Maoist insurgency campaigns, which is the sort of, you know, the becomes the new template for
like the paradigm.
Insurgencies. It's because it works really well. And, you know, like the key thing of Maoist, like, well, I mean, there's a couple of things, obviously, but like one of the key elements of it is this line from Mao. Is it like the gorilla moves through the people like a fish moves through the sea?
Yeah.
Right. So it's about building social bases such that, you know, guerrillas can move in and out of communities and not get turned in and stuff and use them as terrain.
I've had that particular Mao phrase paraphrased to me, I think, sometimes for people who are aware it comes from Mao, sometimes people who probably have just sort of come to it through their own understanding or heard it but not realized the source of it. By people who are not certainly not Maoists all over the world. Like I've heard it in the Middle East, I've heard it in Africa, I've heard it in Asia. Like it is a very important thing, and like it does make guerrilla warfare a lot easier if you can rely on the population.
This is something that's propagated through because of the success of sort of Mao's like guerrilla insurgency. This is something that's propagated through communist parties, but I mean, like, a lot of Islamist groups also pick up a lot of elements of it, because a lot of those groups are trained in the PLO's camps in the Bekaa Valley in Jordan. And so, like, a lot of groups, like, all over the world of completely unrelated ideologies all sort of pick this stuff up. And the British response to this is the British are fighting a communist insurgency in Malaysia. And they're like, okay, we're going to do concentration camps. For our purposes, so obviously this is a you know, this is an unfathomable atrocity, but it has enormous effects even after the war ends, because suddenly, you know, okay, like the war ends, the French are gone, but, you know, 2 million people have been taken from their homes and locked in camps. And this has enormous, you know, I mean, this has enormous economic effects. And the second thing that has really sort of stunning economic effects are there'd been a class of people in Algeria called the colons, who are basically they're the colonists. They're not actually all French. A lot of them are from other European countries, mm-hmm. but they come to be this sort of hardcore French ultra nationalist sort of fascist turbo racists. I guess they're not quite the Rhodesians, but they're only not quite the Rhodesians because they didn't stay to fight it out. And when the French lose the war, when the French pull out, these people just flee. Like, all of them. We're talking like hundreds of thousands of people just are gone. I'm going to read another quote from Clegg because, you know, if these people had merely left, I think a lot of what's going to happen in this revolution goes a lot better. But they didn't just leave. Quote, "In June, a policy of scorched earth was declared, inaugurating an orgy of destruction. With his dream crumbling, the colonist response was to destroy this world." Which I think is a really sort of elegant.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That, I think that's actually very well written. And it's funny. It's this thing that, again, like, you see replicated so often. There was this slogan that they used at the start of the Syrian civil war, like, "Assad or we burn the country."
Yeah. Yeah. And it's this real, you know, so what the colonists end up doing is they end up just destroying.
Yes.
Everything they can get their hands on. They're destroying houses. They're especially destroying any kind of sort of factory or technical equipment. Anything they can find, they're burning, they're lighting on fire. And the other thing about, okay, so Algeria is a colonial economy, right? And the structure of the colonial economy is such that, you know, if you are anyone who has any kind of technical or managerial experience are all colonists, right? Everyone else in the country is either doing subsistence farming or has been fed in as like this sort of like seasonal workers or really, really badly paid sort of contract workers on these sort of like cash crop agricultural farms, a lot of orange production, stuff like that. And so when the colonists flee the country, suddenly, like, the entire technical managerial class, everyone with technical experience, and also all of the bosses and the entire bourgeoisie are just gone. And this takes everyone by surprise. The FLN had assumed, the FLN's the kind of, like, umbrella organization that carried out the revolution. It kind of falls apart very quickly because it's not really a coherent ideological group. It's just a sort of banner that everyone who is fighting kind of attaches themselves to.
Yeah, this is quite common, right? Like national fronts,
yeah,
or like popular fronts very often do this post-revolution.
Yeah, they should disintegrate. But they had all expected that the colonists were going to stick around, and they don't because they're turbo racists, right? And the thought of having to live in an Algeria ruled by Algerians was like, nope, I will fucking literally light the world on fire and flee to France. You know what else is going to light the world on fire and cause people to flee to France?
Is it the products and services that support the show?
Yeah, so how fucking good they are, it's gonna cause the mm-hmm. world to burn and make people flee to France.
Yeah, I have to think about that. When I think about like how big my pile of gold is, I think that it's too small. I'd better just burn it all down and move to France.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if
you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
And we are back. Now, enter here the heroes of this episode. The Workers' Council, or very specifically, so this is a French colony. So in France and in Spain and in sort of, I guess, the Romance languages, there was a concept called autogestion. I'm pronouncing it really badly because I'm reading the French version of it and trying to pronounce it half in Spanish, the only one of these languages I can even sort of speak. But it means self-management, and it basically it has this context of sort of like workers' democratic self-management, right? If you're doing autogestion, you're like the workers of a factory have taken over the factory and are now running it themselves. The most prominent example, and at this point, of self-management is Yugoslavia. Now, the Yugoslavian version is very, very weird, but as a way basically to tell the Soviets to fuck off, Yugoslavia adopts a very different kind of model of socialism than everyone else's. So their model is based on the quote unquote, the withering away of the state. So they're, you know, you have basically these like reasonably democratic, like workers co-ops that are sort of the productive basis of society, and these co-ops sort of compete against each other on the market. But on the other hand, there is a very large level of workers' control that's different from, you know, like the U.S., which is just a pure dictatorship of your boss in the workplace tells you what to do, and if you don't do it, you get fired.
Yeah.
And so Algeria has their own version of self-management. But unlike Algeria, which is sort of effectively imposed by the top down from the Communist Party, in Algeria, what happens is you have this enormous mass of workers who used to work on these plantations, used to work in factories. There's these huge colonial agricultural estates. And what happens is with the entire ruling class gone, and when I say the entire ruling class, we're talking from all the way up from, you know, the highest level government officials through all of your sort of capitalist bosses, right down to sort of the middle management guys are gone.
Yeah.
All those people just have disappeared. So what happens is workers start taking over all of their workplaces, and they start forming workers' councils.
Right.
Now, this is driven largely by, I mean, there's a few different drivers. We'll get to the ideological aspect. A lot of it is that these people have no money, and no one else is going to run it. So the workers who have now seized all of this stuff are like, okay, well, we're gonna get the money we need to survive by running all this stuff ourselves.
Yeah.
And so this sort of starts in 1962, and it sweeps across the country very quickly. I mean, there's a lot of rural regions where it never really takes hold, but largely what's happening is that permanent workers who had been workers at these firms seize control of them. This has benefits and downsides. The benefit of it is, so there's an attempt by the sort of the new Algerian sort of bourgeoisie, the sort of like small faction of Algerian capitalists to buy up all this land. And there's a bunch of really funny stories of these guys buying these estates and showing up in the workers' committee, just kicking them out.
Yeah. Yes, I've seen some of these.
Which is extremely funny.
Yeah.
There's also issues. So part of what's going on is this is the permanent workers taking over the stuff with their people, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times they'll kick out seasonal workers. So it's not perfect. There's a lot of issues with it, right? Because this is all being formed effectively spontaneously by a bunch of extremely desperate people.
That's what I was just so obviously like, because it's me, the point of comparison I'm thinking of is the Spanish Civil War, right?
Yeah.
And worker self-management. But there you have a workforce which has been working towards collectivization for more than a decade in some cases. And also, like, and this is a point actually that gets missed a lot in online discourse about the Spanish Civil War, perhaps because people don't know as much as they think they do. That, like, there were anarchists in all kinds of roles, like when people talk about the Ruti column or whatever. Like, there were absolutely anarchist non-commissioned officers from the military who they relied on heavily for advice. And the same is true with the collectivized workplaces, right? That there were anarchists in many roles, you know, in shop stewards and things like that. Obviously not in, like, the higher management roles. I think doing that is kind of incompatible with anarchism, but... And obviously what we're dealing here with is anarcho-syndicalism for the most part. The FIRE was more of a purist anarchist group. But there you had people who had been working towards this for a long time, who had been planning for it, and who did have people with a variety of experiences in, I think oversight might be a better word than management, perhaps, or like sort of organization. But they were very successful but that didn't just happen overnight. It often gets presented as if it did, as if on like the 18th of July, these people were just sort of going to work. And by the 20th, they were fully formed anarchists running their own workplaces. But that's absolutely not the case.
Yeah. And Algeria is the exact opposite of this, which is there's a very low level of political consciousness. There's organization is almost non-existent because... So, I mean, the kinds of organizations that had existed are, you know, you have these sort of vanguard cells, but those are largely rural. And then you have, there are some unions, but they're not very large because they've been outlawed.
There's repression, right?
The ground. Yeah, like unbelievable repression.
Colonial context is extremely important.
Yeah.
Obviously neither me or I is blaming Algerian workers for not being Catalan.
No, yeah, like this is the French's fault. And you know, but this
many such cases.
But this seizure really takes everyone by surprise because all of the sort of leaders of the FLN, all leaders of the various factions had assumed that either they were going to sort of do I don't know. There's ideological conflict, but they all assume that they're going to do some kind of like giant state-led industrialization project, right? Whether it's a socialist one, whether it's a more Islamist one, and then suddenly they are now all, you know, it's like, okay, well, your economy is now on the Yugoslavian self-management model because all of these workers have just seized all their workplaces. Now there are a few organizations that are politically very supportive of this. The UGTA, which is Algeria's big sort of trade union, are very politically socialist, and they are really the only people in this entire country who are an organized political body who actually want to see this thing work. And so they do a lot of work helping workers set up their committees and spreading the revolution. Their plan is to use this against any attempt to set up basically a dictatorship by, okay. And this is where it gets sort of interesting because very explicitly, they're trying to stave off sort of Soviet style socialist dictatorship, right? And their plan is we're going to use the workers' councils as the basis of an actual sort of workers' democracy against the sort of orthodox, like, Marxist-Leninist stuff. And this is another thing that's going on too, is the army is a lot more orthodox Marxist-Leninist than either the workers' committees or the unions. And so in a lot of parts of the countries in the West, the army just sort of rolls through, knocks off the workers' committees, and seizes the land for itself. And that's a fiasco. But now, pretty very quickly, Ben Bella, who emerges as the leader of Algeria after a set of political maneuvering that we're not going to get into here, is basically forced to in 1963 set a bunch of decrees saying that these guys are the people who run the economy, et cetera, et cetera. But I want to actually get into something that is really not talked about in 99% of the accounts of this stuff, which is how do these councils actually work? Because spoiler alert, this whole thing is going to fail and all these people are going to be crushed. And a lot of that has to do with how this thing's set up, which is very badly because this is a system designed by Marxists and they're very sympathetic Marxists to a broad extent, but unfortunately, the way that this is set up is that, okay, so there's an assembly, right? That's like all the workers in the firm are in this assembly. The assembly elects this workers' council, which has like 10 people. And then that council elects the management committee, which is the people who actually do the management. So it has a president, and there's also a director who's supposed to represent the interests of the state or whatever. And the issue with this is that it's designed specifically to keep power out of the hands of workers directly, right? That giant assembly, it can't actually make policy. The only thing it can do is approve plans or disapprove plans set down by the management committee.
Got it. Okay. And these people at the management committee are presumably like representatives as opposed to delegates, right?
Yeah. They're representatives. They also have 3-year terms.
Great. And they can't be recalled.
I think they can, but it's really hard.
Okay.
And the other thing that sort of destroys this is that there's a lot of sort of like election rigging by the state who doesn't want these things to be actual sort of democratic. And this leads into the bigger issue, which is state control. And this is where I think really, and this is something that Clegg doesn't get into much because Clegg is a Marxist, but where the Marxism of it all really comes into play. But first, do you know who's not a Marxist?
Oh, yes, almost certainly.
Yeah, not Marxists. I think we can say not Marxists.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule-release to learn more.
All right, we are back. So the biggest issue here, and this is something that was kind of true in both Algeria and in the other kind of big Marxist self-management experiments in Chile, which is that the self-managing firms don't have control over a lot of the things that they need, right? So in Algeria, when the state essentially tries to absorb all of this stuff, when it gets sort of legitimized under these decrees, there are a lot of issues. One is that these self-managing organizations don't have control over their own money. So you're getting paid by the state, right? And you give the state your money and then they pay you. And this becomes a real issue because the state goes, oh, well, the people in these self-managing things are actually like privileged workers. So they have permanent pay freezes. And also you can't reinvest your profits back into the firm, which is a real issue.
This is like a horrible combination of like ANCAP and like straight up like Stalinist, like it without. Yeah, I don't want to like derail us too much, but this again, like is a distinct.
It's so much worse than the Spanish system. It's so much worse.
Yes.
Like every part of it is set up to fail.
Yeah. And I think this shit always get, this is the sort of discourse. I am now going to derail us. I'm sorry. The kind of like the online, like hammer and sickle in bio discourse that we see so often. Right. And you don't have to pay attention to those people. And like, you probably shouldn't, but just to like put it out there, I think like, anarcho-syndicalism is right there, and it allows for the like unions and syndicates, which overlook a whole industry, to coordinate between workers' committees and ensure that things get done and people get treated with dignity, and they also make enough money or have access to the resources that they need to survive. And when we try and like cut the corners off this, or kind of make a little collage between this and Marxist-Leninism or state socialism, like neither thing works, and we just end up with this kind of terrible hodgepodge in which it doesn't function, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that worker self-management itself is invalid as a concept.
There's a lot of things here that. You know, so one of the big criticisms of this at the time by socialist intellectuals is people going, well, there's not coordination. The firms are competing against each other. There's not broad economic coordination. It's like, well, yeah, that's because the state controls all their finances. They don't have the ability to do coordination with each other. And the big thing, and this is the thing that really actually kills this, is that. So Clegg calls it marketing is controlled by the state, but that's not quite what's going on. The other thing that's controlled by the state is the state has the responsibility and is the people who are in charge of selling the products. And they just fuck this up completely. They can't figure out how to get like the fruit that's being produced sold, right? The problem here isn't output. It's that the state is doing things like, I mean, sometimes they'll have all these oranges. So a lot of the Algerian agricultural economy is set up as a cash crop economy. And you're supposed to and it's never really worked very well. But the Algerian state just completely shits the bed. And we're talking like tons of fruit is just sitting there rotting. A lot of the time what they do is they just dump it onto the French market for like basically zero cost. And so, you get these things and you look at the sort of profit loss thing and, you know, the sort of like right wing parts of the state and the sort of anti-self-manager parts of the state are going, oh, well, look at these firms, they're hemorrhaging all this money. It's like, well, yeah, they're hemorrhaging money because instead of actually selling the goods, you guys are throwing all of their goods into a dumpster. Like, yeah, of course it's not working, right?
Yeah, and this is a struggle of like post-colonial economies. Like, if you, in the French colonial system, like they've decided that Algeria is going to be the place that makes oranges for the entirety of the French, I'm just sort of manufacturing example, empire here, then evidently once you secede from that empire, you now have a fuck ton more oranges than you need for Algeria. So you're now going to have to navigate, and you might not have enough.
Well, and they can't even figure out how to sell to other Algerians too. That's the problem with the sort of state control of the market. Is they can't do either because the bureaucrats that they're running this are completely incompetent.
Right. Yeah. I mean, one could argue the state's incapable of allocating resources equally or fairly. But yes, even so, they've done a bad job even by state standards.
Yeah, and the subsequent issue too is because all of the finances are controlled by the state, even the firms that are profitable, and there are firms that are very profitable, they can't reinvest their profit back into, you know, improving efficiency or doing the basic things that workers need, which is having money to eat, because that money is just that all of that sort of capital is just being eaten by the state. And so, you know, there's another quote Clegg again. As the president of a self-managed farm said to me in 1965, in this situation, how can we persuade the worker that he is no longer working for a capitalist exploiter? And like, well, yeah, he objectively is, right? He is yeah. Like, the state is stealing all of his money and then doing some stupid bullshit with it.
Yeah, I love that they're like, they're not quite joining the dots there. Like, yeah. These guys don't seem to be getting it. Like, maybe they do. Maybe they do get it.
And this is one of these things where, you know, Clegg doesn't really draw this line because Clegg just refuses to talk about either Hungary or the Spanish Revolution at all, right?
When you're an ML, you really don't like to talk about the Spanish Revolution.
Like, that's the thing. He is a pro worker self management guy, right? Mm-hmm. But he's a Marxist pro worker self management guy.
Right. Yeah.
And so he's attributing the failure of this largely to like, well, there wasn't sufficient consciousness. So it's like, well, no, like this system, even if everyone wanted it to work, this system couldn't have worked because it was set up in such a way that it was, and this is something, you know, this is part of what I want to talk to you about. This was that if you look at the way that the Spanish system is set up, right, it's built off of coordination, like basically like sectoral coordination between everyone who's doing a thing, right? It's built on resource sharing. If I'm remembering my stuff right, I mean, they have a banking union and people put their profits into the banking union and then people can get money from the banking union to reinvest it in other places.
Yeah, I think that's correct. It's also like, yeah, like this, I guess, would that be called vertical integration if it's the whole sector, even if it's...
They do this thing which takes advantage of both of the advantages that self-management gives you, which is one, like, and like sort of, you know, and it's like socialist self-management, right? You have the advantage of scale, which is that you're now, instead of competing against each other, you're now coordinating an entire sector, right? And you're producing stuff for need. And then on the other hand, you have the other thing that's supposed to be the advantage of self-management, which is that the workers themselves, who are the people who are supposed to understand the production process the best, can make decisions over how they're going to do things. But then if you look at the Algerian system, because it's set up by Marxists, it's specifically designed such that basically you're instead of you actually managing yourself, you're just electing your boss and then your boss manages
right.
you.
Yeah.
And that's not actually a good, and it's weird because looking at this, right, this is actually a worse system in terms of self-management, I think, in a lot of senses than the Chinese one. Because the Chinese system is not designed for self-management, but you can't fire people. So because you can't fire people, you have to listen to what people think and what people sort of do. Whereas this system, I don't know, it pisses me off because this is a revolution that very, very easily could have worked. But it was, you know, there's intentional sabotage by the state because most of the sectors of the state don't want this to work. And then just structurally from the way it's set up, it's doomed to fail from the beginning. And the consequence of this is that in 1965, Ben Bella gets overthrown in a coup by another sort of, by basically the army, a sort of state socialist faction of the army. And they hold on to power by basically turning Algeria into an oil economy.
Yeah.
And dismantling this entire thing. And it makes me really angry because the actual Algerian ruling class had the right idea and then they just got completely fucked by everyone who was supposed to be leading them, or, you know, people who were supposed to be selling the stuff that they made, people who are supposed to be reinvesting, all the people who ended up with the financial control just completely screwed them. And I don't know, it's really depressing in a lot of ways. But on the other hand, right, like it doesn't have to go like this, right? You don't have to hand control of your workplace over to some fucking guy in the Department of Agricultural Waste Management or whatever, so he can use your oranges for fertilizer. Like, you can simply not do this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the exact situation that these workers found themselves in, and maybe there was, you know, like a degree of sort of need to get reproducing in order to you know, solve hunger issues. But yeah, you simply do not have to do that as many examples show. Like, I'm thinking of the collectivized farms in Spain as well, because perhaps they would have been a better example, right? Like, I guess there it was slightly different because it was somewhat of a collectivized community that in turn collectivized the land, as opposed to like collectivizing the agricultural labor. And then you have this sort of source of labor which is not inherently tied to the land, and that, like, you know, when there was a need, like, for instance, I'm writing a book right now. I'm writing about the Durruti column, and like, they would, because they had less rifles and they had fighters, they would rotate their fighters off the front line during the harvest time and have people help with the harvest. And then they didn't like need those people the rest of the year, right? So they were able to incorporate like temporary surges in labor without it being like destructive to their model, because it was the idea was like a collective community as opposed to a collective, as opposed to like just the workplace being this island of pseudo collectivization, like you're seeing in Algeria. Also, shout out to the Iron Column, who I've been writing about recently, who solved their supply side issues by by leaving the front line and raiding the cops, because they didn't have enough guns either, so they simply took them from the cops.
Hell yeah!
Cool. Yeah, yeah.
Incredibly based.
Yeah, very based.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the point that I want to end this on, which is that, you know, this is something that contributes to the collapse of Yugoslavia too, is that if you know, the dichotomy that got forced on people in the 20th century was, you can either choose to, okay, so your choices are, you get a Stalinist planned economy completely run by the state, or you get a bunch of workers cooperatives competing against each other, and those are your two models of socialism, and those both suck and both are set up to fail from the beginning, because they're not actually, you know, you're not actually doing the thing. You're not actually having the entire class as a class, you know, abolishing itself and then also managing production in such a way that people are cooperating to produce what people need, instead of everyone fighting over, like, instead of the state setting a steel quota and having that be the entire goal of the economy, or like 17 co-ops and all producing the exact same kind of coffee, trying to figure out who could produce it more cheaply.
Yeah.
We can do better.
Yes, we can, and we have. And that's what we should strive for, I guess. I know if people want to read about the Spanish Revolution, there's a shit ton of books on Libcom. Jose Pirat's book is pretty good. The Senator and the Spanish Revolution. Murray Bookchin has a book about the heroic years of Spanish anarchism. Abel Paz has many books. You can spend time on Libcom and read a lot about collective production in the Spanish Revolution, and for free, which is nice.
Yeah, this has been It Could Happen Here. Go take over your workplace, and then also help everyone else take over theirs and coordinate with each other.
Yeah, that would be very nice. And then we'll do an interview with you on the podcast.
Yay!
Woo!
It Could Happen Here is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more podcasts from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find sources for It Could Happen Here updated monthly at coolzonemedia.com/sources. Thanks for listening.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. It's a literal pro, and it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal, or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May.
Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.